Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Dr. Nikki J. Monti, author of The Divine Traumedy of Nikki Joy, A True Grime Tale. If you've ever pleaded for love, hoped for love, mistrusted love, sabotaged love, started with lousy family-grown ideas about love, compared and despaired about love, or doubted your lovability, then The Divine Traumedy of Nikki Joy is for you. Distinguished licensed marriage, family, and child psychotherapist Dr. Nikki J. Monti has long been internationally recognized as therapist to the stars, both privately and on reality TV, such as Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Millionaire Matchmaker, and more. Her road to success was rocky, though, as before that, she was Nikki Joy Shoulder Balm Burke Ruiz Monti. This complicated name includes two fathers, biological and adoptive, three husbands, a mild-mannered and sweet one, charismatic and brutal one, and boldly eccentric and protective one. This is just the start of Nikki Joy's elaborate life story. What fills in the story includes early parental neglect and abandonment, emotionally sexual incest, generational alcoholism, sex, drugs, alcohol, and food addiction, violent brutality, illegal adventures, divorce, vivid experiences with dying and death, and frequent, edgy, questionable life choices. Dr. Nikki J. Monti is a private practice psychotherapist and world-renowned teacher, group leader, speaker, television and radio personality, and author of several books. Dr. Nikki's main interest is in identifying and learning how to dance with the patterns that guide our lives. She is known as a straight-shooting teacher who believes that change is a matter of choice. Her newly released book, The Divine Traumedy of Nikki Joy, A True Grime Tale, is described as gritty, witty, provocative, dark, sex, drugs, rock the boat, cautionary tale about how it is never too late to love and live. For more information, you can visit her website, which is stucknomore.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Nikki to the show. Good day, Dr. Nikki.
Hi. Oh, my goodness, I need a nap. What a life you've had.
I know. I got tired reading it. It's like, oh, my God. Such a tale. Well, I mean, that introduction alone is what people should go on to buy your new book. So,
yeah.
I'd like to kind of start with, first of all, why write this book now? I mean, you obviously live many different lives within this one. So why this and why now?
Well, you know, as I've been saying, I was called to write this book, really. My husband, who is the one described there as the very eccentric, and I don't know if I said bigger than life, but I often do, adventuresome, a kind of a really truly a true eccentric kind of a guy. We've been married for 32 years. So my first two marriages were quick. I was still in my 20s and I already had two divorces behind me. But you know, I waited a while for this next one. And so I like to think of my first marriage as my drug marriage, my second marriage as my alcohol marriage, and my third marriage is my sober marriage. So, but we had been together 32 years, and he was diagnosed with an illness, and actually turned into two illnesses. And so during the longer part, and we began what I came to call the long goodbye, And he was dying for like 18 months. We had a couple of months off in a summer where one cancer was conquered, his throat cancer was conquered, and then a whole bunch of other cancers rushed in. So we had this, it was right before COVID, and then it was through COVID. So we had the great joy of going through an illness in COVID, which was, you know, meant that our many trips to the ER, which, you know, often he was only in hospital once, but it was for 10 days, and the mother was trying to figure out what was going on with him. And those are all in there. And what's interesting about that is that, of course, everyone alive went through COVID. Well, mm-hmm. I guess over a certain age. So if you're under 5, I guess you didn't go through COVID. all the rest of us went through COVID together. So there's that kind of resonance that I think people have with that. And during the death, we had a very, it were both big personalities, and really he came into my life upon retrospect, and you know, we only really know things in a certain way upon retrospect, right? Mm-hmm. But he came into my life to answer the I must be unlovable because my parents weren't there for me and they sent me away and my father left when I was 4 and my stepfather went on and on my story goes. And so he came, I was the center of no one's world, really, and felt unlovable and like a throwaway person. And Conrad, I was his everything. I went away to give you a quick story. I went away to work with a man, a psycho-spiritual teacher, extraordinary. He never did what I thought he was going to do, Dr. Brujoy. He turned, when I thought I was bringing something brilliant to him, he, you know, burned it to the ground very quickly. And when I thought I sort of was sheepishly presenting something that I was, you know, feeling insecure and embarrassed about, brilliant, wonderful. I'm like, oh, okay, I give up. I'm just going to keep showing up. But I had gone to an early on in my training with him, I'd gone to a workshop, and he did these big workshops you know, 40 people. It was a lot and intense and all these things. And I was just this passionate, I'm compulsive in every way. So I was compulsive about learning as well, which is a good use of my compulsivity. And I came back from the workshop having realized I was born to serve. And, you know, I said, Connor, I was born to serve. And he said, yeah, well, you know, everybody knew that. What is that? And I know, but you understand, it's in my body. I can feel it in my body. I was born to serve. That's my soul's journey. And he said, okay. And I said, no, it's my destiny. And he said, yeah, I know, I can see that. And I said, what is your destiny, do you think? And he said, you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, simultaneously thrilled and appalled. You know, that's a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure. But I was his world. I was his everything. And he had a lot of time for that because I was also the breadwinner and the person who got everybody together for all the events and made the gatherings happen and did the teaching and did da-da-da-da-da. And he was a historian who read a lot, like 3, 4, 5 books a week. So he had, you know, sort of the space for me to be his everything, what he thought that meant. And what it meant to him was that he just held this enormous amount of love for me.
Mm.
We didn't see eye to eye on many things. We were very different in a lot of ways. And there were secrets. We each kept secrets from each other. So, you know, as you read through the book, you see what some of his secrets were that I knew that he didn't know I knew. And some of my secrets were that he didn't know, but then he found out and blah, 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 blah. So there's all those things. But that piece of me that felt unlovable in the process of the long goodbye, and I was trying to take care of myself. I mean, it was COVID. We had to pivot and everything went to Zoom, which was a great gift to me. I closed my office and was working out of the house so I could be just feet away from him. Mm. I had to have 20 hours of most of the time of help. I didn't sleep basically for 2 years because I was also hands-on in service to his illness. And I was running a little corporation, which I ended up calling Monty Abbey, because it was after Downton, because it was, you know, there was this, every new caregiver had a new personality, you know, there were all these things.
Mm-hmm.
It was exhausting, and it was the best version of our relationship we'd ever had, because I didn't expect him to be anybody other than who he was. I didn't think he was going to get up and suddenly go do this and that or be this and that. I was content and grateful to be able to be in service to him through love. That was a big shift for me. That was a huge shift because I'm, you know, basically was controlling and and you know, had spent a lot of my life. I hadn't been for the last 20 years before he died, but you know, pretty shut down and careful. And when I first got, when we were in therapy one time, he had never done therapy. He was sober. He had been sober 20 years when I met him, and I've been sober 5. And he was a lot older than me, but, you know, just because he was sober doesn't mean he was sane, you know. So we went to therapy one time. I think finally got him in therapy, and we went to therapy this one time for a reboot, and this new therapist said, you know, I said, well, you know, truth is I was kind of reluctant about putting myself fully into this relationship. I had a lot of history that said that's not a great thing to do, not safe, blah, 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 blah. And I, you know, I was tentative. And he said, he burst out, you know, you could say that again, you know. Conrad said, and the therapist said, well, what did you do about that? Conrad's sitting beside me, but I'm looking straight at the therapist. And, you know, he's a little way in his own chair, Conrad was. And I said, well, originally what I did was I committed myself from holiday to holiday. For instance, I would go from my birthday in September, I'll say, okay, I'll go to Thanksgiving and then I'll reassess. Mm-hmm. Then I'll go from Thanksgiving to December, Christmas, and then I'll reassess. And then I'll go to Valentine's Day and then I'll reassess. You know, there's a lot of reassessing. And, you know, I wasn't thinking at that moment, oh, Conrad doesn't know this. This was something going on inside of me that I never shared.
Mm.
And all of a sudden he burst into flames and he goes, "Effin' long did you do that?" And I said, well, frankly, it took me years to stop assessing.
Wow.
And, you know, they got longer in between and he was appalled. And I thought that was so clever of me.
Yeah.
To have found a way to stay in because, you know, I was really good at keeping people out. Even though I was mostly always in relationship, it doesn't mean I was always in relationship. And so while he was, to answer the question in my very yet long way, so the reason I wrote this book is I was trying to save my emotional life. I couldn't talk to people at the time because I thought if I mention one thing, I'm going to disintegrate. I'm going to collapse. I'm so overwhelmed by all of these things that I'm doing. And I don't get overwhelmed easily, but it was a lot. And so I started writing. And a friend of mine, a wonderful astrologer that I know, said, you know, you should start an online journal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll need those notes later. And I didn't know what he meant, and I don't think he knew what he meant. But that became the basis for the book, those notes. And then I, you know, and then I was sort of seeking help, and I found a wonderful therapist online, an Englishman living in Spain. What a world, what a time. And, but he was just delicious and wonderful. And I'm sort of, you know, as if I were a good engineer, then I would be very particular about who was putting my engineering stuff together, right? So
right.
As a therapist, I'm really particular about who I work with. So I began to reach out and to open up even more and more, and I got some other kinds of help and things like that. But that started, and then when he died, I just had to write. And I've always been a writer since I was just a little girl. So I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. So that's how the book got started, and then it had many iterations, and it took you know, a couple of years to find its voice.
Yeah.
So all in all, I worked on it probably 4 years before we even, you know, we even began to publish.
It takes a while, particularly if it's a memoir, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to put a life lived, in a yeah. very short book, it can be really challenging.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I've always said I've had lived many lives in this lifetime, mm-hmm. and people like you and many other people have said, wow, you've lived a lot of life. It's sort of a confirmation of what I've always felt, you know.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Now, speaking of writing in younger times, I read in the book that you had an imaginary friend as a child.
Beth. I wish I had those letters now. I used to write letters to Beth. And, you know, and I say in the book, and this is true, I knew Beth wasn't real. It wasn't like I wasn't, you know, right. having a psychotic break, right. at least not at that point. But she was the holder of my secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because she was on the page and came from my own brain and was my best friend, she never disclosed any of those secrets.
Right.
And right. I just felt like, because I'm an only child, I had, you know, and I have almost no, now I have no family, but I had very little family. And, you know, there I was in boarding school, which I had started at 7 and was in for 11 years. I was in 3 different boarding schools. And boarding school is its own special kind of thing. There's a kind of a gang instinct that grows up when you're in a boarding school like that, when you're such an, you know, there were 32 people in my graduating class in high school. 32 people. I mean, it's just, so I wrote that way. And I also wrote, you know, and I started writing very young. And I, you know, one of my remembered first things is a story I wrote called Destiny. I think I was maybe 8 or 9 at this point. A story called Destiny, where you went to a town called Destiny to find your destiny. It was a little on the head, but... Mm-hmm. You know, it was a thing. And in that process of the poetry and the stuff I was writing, I got dubbed Mrs. Edgar Allan Poe. So I was always dark. You know, there was always stuff ruined in there, you know, and I had uh-huh. big questions about how does this all work? And I was always a natural seeker. And also kind of a mother surrogate for the people around me. So they naturally gravitated towards me to tell me their secrets and things like that. So that was fun. But yeah, I was just writing always was a go-to for me in some way or another.
Yeah. So, you know, the reason I wanted to bring that up in particular is because some children, and particularly one child, you know, without siblings, sometimes have that imaginary friend aspect mm-hmm. to their life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if a parent listening currently has a child who has an imaginary friend or two, what would you say to them about that? How would a parent best, you know, kind of make a healthy response to that kind of interaction?
Yeah. Well, if they found out, which is, I don't know who would tell them, because the child wouldn't probably tell them, or they wouldn't have to have an imaginary friend. But let's say something was left around and the parent saw this, or somebody in school saw something and were telling.
Right.
I would say, first of all, for the parent to take a minute or an hour or a day or whatever to reflect on the relationship that they have with that child.
Mm-hmm.
And to wonder, am I actually connecting with my own child from mm-hmm. a deeper place? Do I connect with myself from a deeper place? You know, all of the child questions, and I know this isn't a very popular equivalency, but it always goes back to the parents in the sense, it's like if somebody has a new puppy or old puppy or whatever, and they want that puppy changed or trained, guess what? They go to a trainer, and the trainer trains the parents of that
mm-hmm.
puppy. Because
mm-hmm.
the parents are the problem or the promise, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So first, we always want to look at ourselves. How am I connecting to my child? Do I connect? Oh, I don't really you know, my feelings are, no, I don't think it's family. Let's not look at that.
Right.
So, but it is an indication that there is not a listening ear in that child's life that they feel completely comfortable and safe with.
Okay.
And it's not a bad thing. Like, maybe they write stories, and that's fine. But, you know, in the stories is the truth of their experience, their emotional experience. So it's great if you have, say, you have a creative child and they're drawing certain pictures, or they're writing certain stories, or they're singing certain songs. That's all information for the parent.
Yeah.
If the parent is really listening.
Okay.
And there's that conversation. And it doesn't mean something's wrong with them, but
right.
It does mean there's a communication distance,
right,
most likely between you and the child.
Okay. Well, that's good. Thank you. I wanted to kind of toss that out for parents who are in that kind of situation. Now, mm-hmm. You mentioned also, you know, about a lot of things going back to childhood and the parents. And I read in the introduction of your book that your mother once called you an idealist, but she said it with a wrinkled-nosed sneer.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I read that, I thought, you know, I mean, I have my parents and grandparents' comments, you know, popping up, hopefully
yeah.
not often, but nonetheless, to me, it signals that it made some kind of impression on me. So with that particular one, when that happened, can you tell us, like, you know, how you felt, like, when that happened? And you mentioned, you know, in retrospect, some things look different. And what does it kind of feel the same as it did
yeah.
then in retrospect?
So, yeah, that's a wonderful question, Robert. You know, I do want to say that all healing is a change of perception. It's not, you know, the story's the story, right? And because I have so much what I have come to call, and I haven't read this anywhere else, but what I come to call emotional dysmorphia.
Mm-hmm.
I have just emotional dysmorphia is one thing, but I have emotional blackouts. I have full sections of my life that have fallen away that seem unrecoverable. And so what I do remember, I remember starkly. But there's a lot I don't remember. I have a stark scene, a big traumatic or dramatic or just a vivid scene, but I don't know how I got in and I don't know how I got out. You know, I just remember the moment, like film at 11. But in this particular case, when I remember something like that, it's probably because it's been said more than once.
Right.
Now, my mother was a very smart, creative, just a dynamo, an ambitious dynamo, as was her mother, my grandmother. And unfortunately, she was also an alcoholic, or maybe not unfortunately, just it is that story that my mother was a down and dirty alcoholic. And though I don't use labels generally because I think they're lazy, in this case, it helps to know that she was a malignant narcissist. She was a liar and a cheater and a thief and, you know, all these other kinds of things, which always comes out of insecurity. Right? People don't need to do that if they're secure, right? So for her, she was both scolding me and calling me a dirty name, you know, when she said it.
Yeah, right.
An idealist, you know, as if that was, how's that going to serve you? And she said it that way because she was afraid. I mean, this is on retrospect. I understand that she was afraid of her own soft parts, of her own softer self. She was just, you know, I won't go into the myth of Narcissus, but just to say that, you know, Narcissus fell in love with the sound of his voice and his own image. But he looked in the water, and if you just put your finger in the water where you're looking, everything disappears because there's no there. And that's what the narcissist, the real narcissist, is too bandied around that term, but feels, you know, they feel empty. And so they're trying to fill up with all this other nonsense. Anyway, So when she said that, you know, I can't say I accurately know what I felt, but I know upon reflection, it's an idea that makes me feel good. That if I'm an idealist, it doesn't mean I'm not grounded also. You know, people usually say that, meaning you're unrealistic and everything's crap, and let's just look at the half-empty side of the glass, you know, and the idealist looks at the half-full part of the glass. But guess what? They're both still there, whichever way you're looking. You know, the glass is both half-empty and half-full. So that I have as a part of my system, who knows how this happened?
Right.
Miraculous, but as part of my system, I have faith, and I don't mean that religiously. I mean that just as a standard of, I appreciate that things will turn out the way they're supposed to, which is often not the way I would prefer, but
right.
that it's often better than what I thought it should be. And that I believe in belief. I believe that this is a miraculous experience we're having, this thing called life. And I'm grateful to have found my way through it and to come out on the other side of all my self-created, for the most part, drama and trauma based in my lousy belief system that I developed when I was a kid. But I'm grateful to have come out of it and on the other side, having now the best time of my entire life.
Yeah.
Because after Conrad died, my happily ever after ending happened.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, it took a whole, many, many decades to prepare for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, I, as I say, it's a cautionary tale. It is never too late. It is never too late. If you're working for it and yearning for it and, you know, someone said to me on some kind of interview the other day, they said, what do you say to people who don't want to do the work? And I said, good luck. You should live and be well. What am I going to say?
Talking about, you mentioned earlier when you talked about Conrad passing and not sleeping for a couple of years, even like during that particular period. I just recently, last couple of months, lost my partner of 37 years.
Oh.
And I am in that sleeping zone, no sleeping zone or whatever it is.
Yeah. How long ago was that?
The end of July. So, I mean.
Oh.
Yeah.
Recent.
Very recent.
Yeah.
But,
it's hard no matter what, because, and it takes at least a year, because you've got to go through all of this, all everything, you know, what the birthdays and the holidays and the, you know, all the things. And then I would bump up against, you know, I'd be walking down the hall minding my own business and I'd bump up against a memory, or I, you know, suddenly I would look there, you know, and I, at the beginning, I just, as I went to the store to buy things just for me, because, and I hadn't done that in many decades, right? I mean, I would always, let me get this and that.
Please.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say to people, my husband's dead! Like they would care, you know? You know, oh, that's a lovely ring you have. Thank you very much. But what I wanted to say is, yeah, my dead husband gave
it. Oh, goodness. Well,
and the, but the world goes on.
Yeah,
and that's the story, isn't it? But
it is.
I say be in the grief when it comes up.
Yeah.
Be in the mad when it comes up. Be in the loss. Because loss is an astonishing gift.
Yeah.
It, you know, like up and down and in and out and half empty and half full, it gives us a measure of having, if you don't experience loss, which is impossible, of course, but if you experience great loss, that's because you had great having.
Yes, I agree. And when I come across or bump into those memories, sure, there is sadness and grief, but then I quickly try and bounce back to the idea of, well, you know, there was something there that created the memory. I mean, you know, there was that love that was there. And be happy that I experienced that. So
that's right. That's right. That's right. And yeah. And the more you know, how do we deal with all those losses along the way? I mean, the little heartbreaks, the big heartbreak. How do we deal with that? Well, we mine for gold. What did I learn through this? What did I learn through the awfulest parts of my life too? What did I learn? If I learned nothing, oh well. Next. But I say that to every single person who walks through my doors, every time they walk through my door, every client, every couple, every whatever. What have you learned this week?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know. I think nothing really came up. What do you mean nothing came up? Were you alive this week? What do you mean?
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back to that perspective you were talking about, you know, that just keeping, being aware of what's going on and what changes are happening.
Yeah. Well, you know, with you and your partner, I think when you, I know that you have had limited time to look at the book, but now you're going to go and read it in depth. And there's a lot of material around loss in that, you know, at some point. So just kind of buckle up, Robert, because it's all great, but it's, you know, it's truth. It's reality.
I understand, yeah. And that helps, too. Now, when it comes to writing the book, many times authors will start a book with a quote. I've done that in my books, too. Mm-hmm. But yours, I'm going to read it, and I want you to tell me why you chose this quote. And it was...
Okay.
You have brains in your head. You have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself any direction you choose, which is from Dr. Seuss. So,
right.
Why did you feel that was a good way to start the book?
Well, you know, because the platform on which I stand is that change is a matter of choice, and that we are in charge of the choices we make. It doesn't mean that life won't, you know, throw us potholes and barriers and all kinds of things that it does. It doesn't mean that we're never in charge of outcome, but we always are in charge, though we don't know it even as children to some degree. We're in charge of the choices we make. You know, are we kind or cruel? Are we inviting or off-putting? Are we excited or barely visible? We have predispositions, and we've learned from the best teachers ever, which are called the parents, because children learn three ways, by example, by example, by example. And I thought that was a kind of a easy door in or window peek into this notion that we can go in any direction we choose. That doesn't mean we can be anything we want to be. And that is an annoying idea to me that people use. You know, yeah, parents say, oh, you can be anything you want to be. No, I can't.
Right.
I started out to be five, 2.5 now, but I started out to be 5'5". I'm not going to be a basketball player. I am not built. I'm busty, and I'm short. I'm not going to be a basketball player. Don't tell me I could be that, because I can't, you know.
Right.
My brain doesn't work very mechanically. I'm sort of challenged. I'm wonderfully creative, and there's a lot of things I'm interested in. But I can't put a chair together. I can't. I've tried. I'm no good at it. I have no spatial, I'm depth perception problems, and I have no spatial whatever. And I have no patience. I am not going to be a carpenter. I'm not. That's not going to happen, you know. So,
no.
But you can be anything you want to be within your, I would say, destiny, or within your, reflects your soul's true intention.
Right.
And that you work really hard at. You know, but you can't be anything. You want to be. But you can choose which direction to go. You can choose which direction to go. You can go towards the dark. You can go towards the light. You can go towards wholeness. You can, I made some terrible choices based on my lack of self-love.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to move through that. But the whole time I was, you know, trying to figure it out. And so I chose that. I chose to go in a lot of, the reason I had so many adventures and lived so many lives is because I kept looking for the life to live.
Mm-hmm.
I kept trying to find myself in the right, you know, in the right configuration. I kept trying to create my belonging or find my belonging, find my way home to myself. And, you know, a lot of things got in the way because I put them in the way. Because the fear was bigger than the faith.
Now, with those questionable choices, no regrets or some
regrets? No regrets. Zero regrets. Now, because I don't think that's a helpful thing. Regret, remorse, I don't get it. How is that helpful? I will say, you know, and I used to try to do that. Oh, well, I could just skip that second husband. He was pretty lousy. But but then being with him took me to this, which took me to this, which took me to this, which took me to that, which took me to this, which took me here with you today, Robert.
Right.
So
yeah.
How would I pull that out? Could I have, you know, some of my choices were way questionable, no question. Now I have this family that came with Tom, my partner, and I had no family, and now I have this enormous family. They've been hugely embracing and inclusive, and we have this little baby in the family now that just got born 3 months ago. And so though I thought I was going to have a million children, I ended up in the book, there's a piece about how a child was born and died very quickly afterwards and all that, because, you know, why would I want to skip that fun?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I ended up not having children. Big surprise to me. So obviously I wasn't going to have grandchildren. Well, Tom's wife died 6 months before Conrad died. So that is how we were available for each other and found each other, because we're moderns, on Hinge.
Just
impossible. It was miraculous that we found each other. I really feel. So, and this has been gorgeous. So now there's this baby, and the mother of the baby is the daughter of the wife that died.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now I am dubbed grandma. So I get to be Graham. And it's an extraordinary experience. And the first time I was holding that baby was a few days after he was born. I had this layers of feeling come wash over me, layers of feeling. Gratitude, profound, profound gratitude of the beauty of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some regret because I always thought my lost baby would come back to me and I would birth that child. And that did not occur.
Yeah.
And so there was that. On the other hand, I would not have the life I have if that had happened. I would have a different life. And my life has been extraordinary.
Yeah.
So, you know, so every time I have a moment of regret, it's immediately, there's an immediate announcement in me of the power of gratitude.
Mm-hmm. And that, to me, seems to be a healthy way to position that feeling of regret, you know. And I know that so many times if one just can shift a perspective or recognize that all of the stuff of our past is what contributed to the present and how, you know, how thankful, you know, many of us are going through some of those challenges without being stuck in those challenges.
That's right. That's right. We'd be stuck no more. So can I ask you a question, Robert? This is kind of, you know, how are you doing with your grief?
Overall, okay. You know, there are periods of intense sorrow, but and there are also periods of kind of looking forward to, like you mentioned, you know, going to the grocery store and buying just what you want. I just, you know, when I first had to do that, it was like, oh my God, you know, I don't have to buy, you know, what he wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
or even on the television programs we had programmed, you know. Some of them were on time, some of them were not. It was like, no, I don't want to watch that. I even tried to watch what was his favorite, and I just, no.
Not me.
So so there is that period of self-discovery in a way, you know. So I try to look at that, and with each kind of day, I just look at it as the new chapter. You know, what am I going to write in this new chapter?
Right, that's right, and it is. There is. It's exciting to think of it in a sense as a new chapter. And some people go into guilt, right? So if I go into a new chapter, am I betraying the last chapter I had? You're not, because I don't think we honor anybody by living in the dying process with them forever.
Right.
Whatever happens after death, they're doing that.
Yeah.
Or they're doing nothing. We don't know.
Right.
But whatever it is, our job is to take what we've learned in the love or the anger or the grief, whatever it is, and to move forward with it.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, it is. I know it's going to take a while. And
yeah,
that's just the way it is. And, you know, and I have a strong belief in the afterlife. Oh, and I also have faith, again, not religious like you indicated, but, you know, and recognize that, you know, he's out doing his thing where he is, and, you know, time for me to do my thing where I am. So
Yeah. Somebody asked me very soon after Conrad's death, can you feel him there in the house? Because we were here, I've been in this house 30 years. And I said, is he there? I said, I'm very intuitive and I'm super psychic and all of those things. And I'm very into energy and I'm a connection to energy. Not really. Now, he smoked a pipe for a long time, so I can smell him still, but but not exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those people, I've watched many people die. I have worked quite a bit with death and dying also, and being with people and you know, sort of working with them as while they're dying. And I am just not one of those people where, for instance, my mother never came to me after she died. My had this great, wonderful sort of guy who introduced me to a lot about Eastern religion, and we were briefly lovers and whatever. He died suddenly, didn't come to me after he died. And some chick he was with for 20 seconds, she announces on Facebook, "Yes, I got a ticket for Bodhi last night." I'm like, "Oh, you did not. I don't believe you." And then Conrad died, and a woman I know, which is, this is in the book too, calls me and says, "I had a dream about Conrad and you last night." And I believed her, and she told me the dream, and I knew exactly what the dream meant because I do a lot of dream work. But, you know, I'm just not that. It's like, I'm done with you. Okay. Next.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and that's really been the pattern of my life as well. I mean, when I have a falling out with friends, or friends get over me, or whatever that has happened in the past, they're gone.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, let's rekindle this. No. They leave and they're gone. And that's the pattern. You know.
Well, yeah. Well, I've had a couple of dreams came a week and a half after. But they, you know, in context, they were very calming. Haven't had one since. But it seemed to me that it was a way of trying to put me at ease. And whether or not it was an actual.
Let me do a quick share with you, Robert, about that.
Sure.
So the belief system that I was taught and work with is that the psyche prepares. I know I'm very Jungian, right, Carl Jung?
Okay.
So the psyche prepares us decades sometimes in advance for dying. So many, many years before Conrad got sick and died. He had a dream about a friend of his, and this friend is named Harriet, and again, this is in the book. I just love this story. And she had, when I met her, she was old, let alone when I met her with him, she was on a walker and all that. But anyway, she had been dead a number of years, and one day, Conrad woke up and he said, "God, I dreamt about Harriet last night." I said, "Oh, how so?" And he said, "Well, she was just there," and she always called him Monty by his last name. And I was like, "Okay." So she said, "She was just there," and she said, "Hey, Monty, how you doing?" And I said to her, "Good, Harriet. Do you know you're dead?" and she said, "Yeah." And he said, "How is it?" And she said, "Pretty good." And that was the dream.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was a visitation. To me, that was a visitation.
Yeah.
And a preparation.
Yeah, I can understand that. Well, you know, and I too love the dream state. I have a dream journal that I write in whenever I have very memorable kinds of dreams. We are getting close to the end of the interview, so I want to mention, I know, we will have to do this again. But
I know.
There was one particular aspect to your book. You know, you talked about addiction, you know, and all the various forms of addiction, mm-hmm. and that why being a functional addict, either on pot, alcohol, work, sex, whatever, isn't actually functional. So for people who may be feel that they're a functioning addict, why would you say that it's just not functional?
Because we're not fully awake in that state. We cannot, first of all, you know, there's a lot of science now that talks about even one drink affects the brain negatively. It just does. That's mm-hmm. science. And I'm not very scientific, but that, you know, it's nice to have a little backup there. But
right.
it, on the deeper level, we cannot be fully awake if we keep numbing ourselves. We cannot operate from clarity if we're fogged over. It's like driving your car with a mist over it and never using your windshield wipers, you know, and saying, "Well, I can just squint here and move through the mist." And you're endangering yourself. You could go off a cliff or ram another car or go into the side of a mountain. It is not, you know, and you're not fully awake to your own libidinous life flow and to your own capacities. And why are you doing that? Why are you choosing? And people tell me it's fun. Look, I've been there. It's not that much fun.
Yeah.
To be unconscious, when we have a choice, you know, look, we're barely conscious anyway when we are awake. It's of course, the Jung model is that we have this tiny little top of the iceberg peeking up, and all the rest of the iceberg is under the water where the unconscious lives, which drives our life, you know,
yeah.
the unconscious. So to be awake to possibility and to be clearer and clearer about the choices we make, and if we make lousy choices, do it with at least clarity. I mean, yeah. you know, that's all I want for people is choice, to know that they have a choice, and at least to suit up, show up, and be there in the moment. Moment by moment, we have a choice. Again, we're not in control of outcome, which is just people hate that. I hated it,
right.
and I still run up against that distaste for not being in control of outcome. But again, it usually is better than I decided it should be. You know what I mean? Something better has happened. But that, and it's a world that supports going to go asleep, not to be awake. It's a world that supports that. And if you're addicted to the internet or to anything, if you're addicted to gaming, if you're addicted to anything and you do it routinely, or Candy Crush, for God's sake, anything that takes you out of being present to the magnificence or the wonderment or the horror that life is offering to bring to you, to show you how you can be more and have more and love more and laugh more and whatever it is, you're shortchanging yourself. You are shortchanging yourself. And by the way, when you shortchange yourself, you shortchange us. And
yeah.
if enough of us are shortchanging ourselves and each other, the world is going to stay the mess it has been and continues to be, getting worse and worse as far as
yeah.
I can see.
I agree. Messier and messier, for sure.
Absolutely.
So my final question is, what do you hope the reader will take away from reading The Divine Comedy of Nikki Joy?
I hope they will take away an understanding of their own empowerment, power through vulnerability, power through open-hearted love, and taking responsibility for the choices they make. It doesn't have to feel like a trudge through the darkness, this life we have. It's not going to feel like it's sunny all the time, but that's okay. You know, mushrooms grow in the dark, they're still pretty tasty in the final analysis, you know. You got to throw some other stuff in there, otherwise it's just like, I don't know what that is. But anyway. But the point is, I hope they take away hope, invigoration, excitement, and remembering.
Yeah.
The knowing that you can put yourself back together again and make contact with your true voice. You can go, I mean, I have transformed myself. And it's been work. Sometimes it's ugly. Sometimes it's beautiful. But in the final analysis, I'm living my best life.
That's perfect. That is so wonderful. And I think that feeling more hope in encouragement after reading the book, I think, is a compliment to the author manyfold. Yeah.
Well, I hope. I just got a review from someone who just read the book and was saying exactly that it was, you know, so empowering. And for her, she said she couldn't put it down. And I've had that several times now, and I can't. That is, you know, for an author, you know, I can't put it down. I love that.
I'm going to be one of those saying the same thing. So,
yeah.
Well, Dr. Nikki, I really want to thank you for your time today. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation tremendously.
Thank you so much. It's so I can feel you're listening even on the phone, even though I can't see you, and I can feel it, and I can feel the connectivity between us, and that's a gorgeous thing. We have just had a wonderful relationship.
Perfect.
And how can we ask for more?
And we're connected now on Facebook, so I'll be able to follow your
journey
closer.
Yes.
Well, everyone, I want to let you know that this is a great time to pick up Dr. Nikki's book for you or for a family, for the holidays. Great gift idea. So, and in closing, I want to thank you all for listening to this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.